I'm not sure if there is supposed to be a formal welcome to this session today, but let me take this opportunity to say thank you for sharing your noon hour with me. And we'll go through some of the expectations related to high flex learning and coming back to campus in the fall. I'll make a few comments and then I'll open it up for questions. These noon hour sessions are a response to questions we've been getting from campus in a variety of different areas, and thought it would be a good opportunity to just to meet with people daily on certain topics. People can attend if they'd like, or not attend if not, and we'll continue to make these sessions available as we get closer to school starting. So can you see the PowerPoint slide that I put up on the screen?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. I just put up a short slide to guide my comments as we go through the material. So the high flex course design model is based on components of hybrid learning and a flexible course structure that gives students the option of attending sessions in the physical classroom or participating in sessions online, or the ability to do both depending on the day. And of course, that opportunity extends to our faculty as well, if, for example, they're vulnerable and don't want to be in the classroom this fall. Usually when high flex models are described, they're accomplished through a combination of delivery methods that include face-to-face instruction or a traditional live in-person classroom, a synchronous or real-time remote learning experience, so it would be a synchronous online course, for example, and also an asynchronous or more independently timed course instruction that's taking place. Now you'll see I put asterisks by the face-to-face and the synchronous learning on my slide because those are the two areas that NDSU will focus on this fall. We heard repeatedly from our students last spring and also through the summer that they really value the face-to-face experience. They want to be back on campus. They want to have real-time interactions with faculty members and their fellow students. And so we want to make the face-to-face instruction available to them. And for those who are not able to be in the classroom, we also want to have the real-time synchronous option so they can be participating in that live classroom at that time. That's not to say faculty might not want to add an asynchronous online component to their courses. Many faculty do that with their face-to-face courses already if they ever record lectures or provide problem sets to students that they can work on independently. But we're not asking our faculty to do all three things for fall semester. So I think that's one area of confusion that faculty have run into. It's like, do I have to have face-to-face, synchronous online, and asynchronous online this fall? And you really don't. What we want you to focus on is that live face-to-face experience with students. High flex learning allows you to do lots of things with remote students that you can do live in the classroom. You can have small group exercises or activities. You can have students collaborate on work that's going on in the classroom or in the remote site. The important thing with the hybrid class is that you are tailoring the design of your course to those remote students as well as to those in the classroom. And so that's where the shift in our pedagogy happens. If we're used to teaching face-to-face, we also have to think about, so how do I most effectively bring those remote students into the live classroom and help them feel like they're a part of this system? High flex it's a conceptual framework. It's a design model. It's not a technology. So what we do is we use other resources that we have to support the high flux design. So very commonly, people will do high flux using their institution's course management system. For us, that's Blackboard. So you might incorporate heavy use of Blackboard, and to get that live stream component, you would use Blackboard Collaborate, or you can use Teams or Zoom or other mechanisms to bring that real-time experience. As I understand, the technology that's needed at the most basic level, and I will let Mark and Christy chime in if they want to correct me or add more detail, but you need a camera, video conferencing capabilities, and then a way to interact with the students at a distance. And so as part of the North Dakota CARES Act funding, that is what our ITS division is putting into our classrooms on campus so that we will have the built-in capacity to do high flex learning in our normal classroom environments. And there are lots of options that you can do with the technology. I just listed some that I've seen some of our faculty using both last spring and preparing for summer. You know, you can stream your lectures live, but you may choose to record them so the students can play them back later. So that would be an asynchronous option for them. You're not required to do that, but that's one thing that's fairly common that people do. Some people also do asynchronous discussion boards or collaborative writing projects that take place outside of the classroom. Again, not required to do that this fall, but it provides some food for thought on how you might approach your class. The real goal behind a high flex class is to help make the remote students feel like an integral part of the class, to try to pull them in and engage them just as you would with your face-to-face students in a normal classroom. And so it's that as you're teaching, to be thinking about those people who are not in the classroom or sitting in front of you as you teach, or if you're teaching remotely this fall, how are you going to engage with people that aren't in your immediate environment? I say that as I'm desperately trying to watch for nonverbal feedback amongst our participants today, because as an instructor, that's what I'm used to following. You know, what are my students thinking? How are they reacting? What do I need to do differently? And so on. Ideally, in a really well-designed high-flex class, the technology, the course design, the pedagogy, and the engagement of the students all line up to have a really positive experience. We hope you have those things in alignment in the fall, but teaching a high flex course is like teaching any other course, whether it's a face-to-face course or an online course. Usually the first time you teach it, you're still learning, rolling things out, trying things to get people's reactions. I've often heard it said that it takes about 3 course offerings to really get your class down. First time is it's all new, trial and error, let's see how this goes. By the second time you teach it, you're starting to kind of get into the groove and know how to make things work well. By the third time, you feel pretty comfortable. So that's probably going to happen this fall as well, if it's your first experience with high flex. You're going to be learning, the students are going to be learning, and you just have to be patient and kind of flexible as you're doing it. Also, in a high flex course, ideally, once it's all developed and working well, students have multiple pathways to work through course content. And it might be different for those who are live or synchronous or asynchronous. You maybe don't get to that or won't get to that point this semester, but it's a goal to be thinking about in the future, is how do you make the course as adaptable for students to be able to master the material in the way that they learn best. Like I said, you may not have that ready to go by fall, but it's something to keep in the back of your mind for the future. So that's my quick overview, but I'm happy to respond to your questions. or discuss some of the things you're thinking about. If anybody wants to share some of their, either the best practices that you've learned about or that you're trying yourself, I would love to hear those. Be great to share some examples.
Margaret, do you want a question from the chat?
Sure.
Okay, first one from Mark McCord, is face-to-face mandated for faculty?
Good question, Mark. For most faculty, we would like there to be a face-to-face component of your class because our students have asked for that kind of interaction. They've been wanting that attention from their faculty last spring and over the summer. And so we're trying to do as much face-to-face or synchronous remote as we can. There may be some exceptions. Any class that was typically scheduled to be asynchronous online is still scheduled to be asynchronous online. Our campus has quite a few offerings that are exclusively taught that way or taught in the fall that way. Or if there is a special exemption for some reason, a faculty member may be allowed to teach asynchronously online, but those are evaluated on a case-by-case basis. The department head, the dean, and the provost talk about those situations. Does that cover it, Mark, or do you still have questions?
So I've unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. No, I'm just asking, I not for me. I'm not teaching in the fall in any case, but, you know, I've heard from many people, you know, I'm a faculty senator and I keep in touch with my constituents, many of whom express some trepidation about, you know, wandering into to the potentially dangerous environs of many, many students, and they're rightfully concerned about about why, you know, why they're being made to do this when it's a very great risk to them.
Mark, they do have the ability to teach remotely.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
They don't have to be. Yeah, they don't have to be face to face. We want them live in that classroom at the time the course is offered, but they don't have to be physically present. One of the great things.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah,
the technology. Thank you. That answers my question.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Next question.
I got one from another from the chat here. Mm-hmm. We have students from the other side of the world who can't get to Fargo, but will begin their studies. How will they get courses if not asynchronously?
That is another good question, and it's a little bit easier now since some of the international restrictions have changed where students can start courses from abroad that are online. Whether or not the university offers those courses online asynchronously is another question. Those students would also have the ability to participate remotely in the live synchronous classroom, but whether or not that works with the time differences, you know, it might be that your course is offered in the middle of the night. And so students would have to make that kind of choice. You know, if faculty are willing to adapt a course to provide an asynchronous option to accommodate a student who is abroad, I think that's very generous. Wouldn't stop you, but I also wouldn't tell you have to do it either.
I'm sorry, I just need to follow up. I'm sorry, everyone. How do my students go about finding out if the course will be offered asynchronously so that they don't have to get up with a 13-hour time change?
The courses that are scheduled now to be asynchronous are coded that way in the schedule. If you as a faculty member were opting to do that for a student who's abroad, I would say you can work directly with them unless you're willing to do that for everyone who might want it that way, which is kind of contrary to what we're trying to accomplish with the face-to-face experience on campus, but certainly understandable if an international grad student or undergrad student can't get into the U.S. because of visa issues and whatnot.
Thank you.
Yep.
Margaret, I have a question regarding procedures for faculty who may want to teach remotely in that live mode. Mm-hmm. Is there, earlier you had mentioned that they would need to provide that information to their chair so the information could be provided to students. And there had also been something about the remote work agreement. So I just want to make sure when I'm working with faculty, if they are in that position of not feeling safe going into the classroom, they're definitely willing to teach live and answer student questions and do that engagement live. What steps do they specifically need to take so everyone is on the same page and we're able to keep things organized?
Make sure I address all the parts of that question.
Sorry, it was kind of lengthy. Thank you.
No, it's fine. Excellent question. I just want to make sure I get to all of it. So earlier this summer, some of the academic advisors and faculty who advise students were getting questions from students on how will I know if my faculty is going to be in the classroom or teaching remotely? And some of them had a preference, like, I really want someone who's there in person. I learn best that way. Can you tell me which classes to sign up for? And so I had asked the deans to submit information for their colleges on which of their faculty are planning to teach remotely this fall. So we'd be able to share that information with advisors, whether it's professional academic advisors or faculty who advise. It's not something that we plan to share with all students. It's something that if they wanna know, is their professor live or remote or how this is gonna work, they can talk to their advisor about it. We're learning a lot as we go through this pandemic and realize there wasn't a very easy way to merge the fall course schedule with the plans of our faculty. And so Mark Wallman and Cece and his office have created this wonderful live integrated document where you can in real time make updates for your department. So let's say somebody starts face-to-face, but they have to quarantine and now they're going remote. The department head can go in and quickly change that spreadsheet to reflect that change. And Mark can add to this if he wants. We shared it with department heads at their meeting last week and showed them kind of what it looked like and what we needed to have them do at this point. We had some missing information or some confusing information. We piloted it with a couple departments. I think communication was one of them to make sure it was working okay for faculty and whatnot. And then I believe Mark plans to circulate that document on August 7th, this Friday, that it'll be ready to share. So that is how students can find out if their faculty member is teaching face-to-face or remotely by going through an advisor to acquire that information. What was another one of your questions, Carrie Ann? Yeah,
so I think fundamentally I'm asking what the procedure that someone who is planning to teach remotely should follow. So the first is to notify their department chair so that information is added to the right spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The second question is, do they have to complete a remote work agreement through HR in order to do so?
Good question. I suggest you look at the remote work site background material that's on the website. They really do a nice job of walking through who needs to submit that paperwork and who doesn't. It is for faculty, staff, graduate students, all employees of the university. And what triggers the need for that worksite remote document, as I understand it, is that you're working remotely consecutively for 30 days. So normally, faculty are pretty fluid in when they work on campus, when they work at home, when they work in other places, because we all tend to gravitate to the space that we're most productive in. But when it gets to be 30 consecutive days or more, then you need to have that documentation on file with HR. And what I've seen with a lot of our faculty who are working remotely is they may be working remotely from their office. So they may be on campus, but they're just not wanting to go into the physical classroom. In that regard, they would still be on campus, so they wouldn't have to fill out that kind of agreement. We have several who are kind of going back and forth. On campus, off campus, they're coming in for some things, they're teaching remotely. That would not trigger the 30-day consecutive timeline. But if you are planning to be, like if somebody knows they're going to be teaching remotely and not coming to campus all semester, you should have that documentation on file.
Thank you.
As I understand it, it's important for our workers' comp and other coverages that the university has that benefit the employee.
Hey, Dr. Fitzgerald.
Oh, John, good. Yay. The perfect person to respond.
And really, Pat Hansen, these approvals go through her, and you're right in everything that you said. And next week, I believe on Tuesday, we have one of these sessions where Pat, as well as Jennifer and myself, will be talking about the telecommute agreements and stuff like that.
Thank you.
Margaret, I'm going to take over some of the chat moderation. Mark lost the chat feed. So we've got a question about how do we document our CARES Act funding? What do we need to do to meet the funding that was provided?
Oh, great question. As part of the CARES Act funding, we received a fairly significant amount of money to provide supports for salary stipends to adapt courses for high flex learning in the fall. I'm going to talk about a lot of different things related to those stipends because I've been getting a lot of questions lately. Number one, people want to know when they're going to get paid, and that's an excellent question. The time period to start reporting work for most of our faculty is the August 1st to August 15th time period, which means the first payment would show up in your August 31st paycheck. And we have to do the payments over time. So they'll go from, for most faculty, the end of August till the end of December. So you'll get part of that stipend. The stipends are all $5,500 divided up through your paychecks. There are some of our faculty who paying them this additional award gets a little more complicated, and it particularly affects our faculty who have 12-month salaries largely through grant funding. And so Jody DeWald in my office is going to be working individually with those departments and those faculty to figure out the best time to pay them. You know, as far as we know right now, they're still going to get their stipends, but we may have to stagger the timing to align with their effort reporting on their grant and whatnot. So just be patient. This is a pretty heavy lift for Jody and our department to process all of those payments for people, but we anticipate that the first round of dollars will start coming into paychecks on August 31st. And if you're one of those folks who were having a little more challenge figuring out how to pay, you'll know it, because we'll be trying to find out, does your grant allow for overload? If you don't have overload, is there a time period when you're more available for payment and whatnot? So those are very unique situations. There's still CARES money available for stipends. the vast majority of it has been used at this point. We are trying to retain a little bit for new faculty who are starting on contract on August 16th. We can't award them a stipend or pay them until they're on contract, but we know for many of them, they are going to be adapting their courses to HyFlex. And so if possible, we'd like to extend this opportunity to them. And so I'll be asking, I have Dean's Council tomorrow, I'll be asking the deans to tell me approximately how many faculty they think they'll have coming in August who might be applying for these stipends. So we hopefully we'll be able to serve those new faculty as well. There's well over 550 stipends. I'm not sure what the exact total is today. They've really stopped coming in as frequently. I think 4th of July weekend, we had our peak of applications and then it's gradually tapering off. In terms of effort reporting, learning as I go, I thought that the final report due at the end of the semester would be adequate. So when I put out the applications, I asked for a one-page or less summary of the work you've accomplished. We have to be accountable for how we spend the CARES money. It's very likely that we will be audited. So we are trying to be very, very careful with how we make those allocations and what the money is used for and have meticulous records that we can share with auditors when the time comes. We also need to have a monthly effort report. So I've designed a very short Qualtrics survey. The instructions are far longer than the actual questions that Melissa Lamp will send out. She'll do the first one in the middle of August, around August 15th or so, where you just kind of tell me what you've done to adapt to HyFlex so far. So from summer to the time you fill out the survey, what did you work on? And it might be, I went to training through ITS. I sat in on Dr. Beatty's session about HyFlex pedagogy. I revised my syllabus. So that's what you would report on that survey. That's the main question that I need to have the answer to, is like, how are you accounting for the award in that first block of time? Some of our faculty maybe have gotten the whole course developed by now, and that's fine, but I'm anticipating most of our faculty will have a lot of things ready by the time classes start, and we'll continue to work on that class through the semester because it seems like we're always tweaking, improving, revising, so that will go on. So you'll get that short little Qualtrics survey once a month. Again, the main question is kind of tell me what you've been working on. I also put in a question about what's going well or what are you most proud of, just because I want to hear some of the creative ideas or the positive things that are coming out of this. I also have a question in there about what challenges or barriers are you running into? Because if you're having a problem that I can help with or get you the resources or support you need, I want to be able to do that too. So you'll have the short monthly reports, and then the final report, again, is just a one page or less. I would suggest cutting and pasting from your monthly reports to the December report. And again, all of that tracking is for accountability on the part of the university that we used our money appropriately and accomplished great things with it. Did I hit all your questions about the CARE stipends?
I think that was the only one specifically related to that.
Okay.
There are a lot of them here. okay. It was going back up to one quite a bit ago, and then I know Mark's been answering a few in the chat. So if you don't get to yours either, we might run out of time, or Mark's trying to answer some of them if he can. This is one it doesn't look like was answered. What are the strategies to hold exams to maintain fairness?
There are a couple different ways you can approach how you do examinations. and I'll give you some very broad sweeping examples. One thing that faculty members sometimes do if they are not in face-to-face contact with all their students and able to proctor their exams is to write an exam in a way that you know students are going to be looking up materials or resources, and you give them permission to look up materials. And then you write your questions in a way that the way they're able to answer that successfully is they really know the material. They might have some reference material that they pull in to help them do the questions. And I'll give you an example. When I was teaching online for the Great Plain Interactive Distance Education Alliance, I had graduate students. There was some very fundamental knowledge that I wanted to make sure they knew before they finished that class. And I know we don't often give multiple choice exams to our graduate students, but I would do short multiple choice exams for them with the instructions that use your book, use your notes, use whatever you resources you want. You just have to know this stuff. And so, you know, they would go through and do those. But then for their major evaluative assignments, I had them writing papers or doing projects or things that required this kind of integration of knowledge and resources that it would be very difficult to cheat on. And again, that's easier in a graduate class that's smaller than it would be in a very large undergraduate class. But if you're teaching a large undergraduate class, you can do that same approach of designing an instrument where you know they're going to be able to check resources and just make sure it taps into what you really want them to know. We've had some discussion about getting the academic integrity software programs. And Mark, I think, did you end up purchasing a license for one of them?
No, all our venues for money ran out.
Oh, okay. All right.
We had asked for a supplement from CARES funding because some specific products came up as a request after we submitted our initial one. Mm-hmm. And the additional supplement was denied. And we also tried to get it through the university system because they had some money for it. And that was also denied. Okay. And so I think we're out of luck on anything new at this point.
Okay. And I've heard mixed results on things like ExamSoft or some of the other programs about how effective they are and if they're easy or difficult for students to use. I know a lot of you have expertise in how to test in the remote environment. If you would like to pitch in with your suggestions, maybe raise your hand and Christy can call on you. Anybody? Oh, Jill raised her hand. Jill Zuber.
The one thing I've found that's useful is to, once they access the assessment, the quiz test, they only have a certain amount of time to respond to all the questions and submit it. If you can time it appropriately based on what had happened in a face-to-face classroom, that's helpful. That will reduce the amount of time that they can just look through the textbook for information and have them rely on more of what they actually know and maybe like just refer to a few notes when responding. Also, McGraw-Hill, if you're using Inclusive Access this fall, they have already included in the inclusive access price for the student some features for proctoring, like making sure there's only one screen used for looking at the questions and responding to them. So that might be worth something.
Mm-hmm. Good suggestion, Jill. Thank you. Anybody else?
I think the Blackboard or Blackboard at NDSU have these random blocks that we can create a bank of questions like 100 questions, and we ask that program to draw 10 questions for each student. So students will have a different question, limitation of time, cannot get back and forth between questions to look at. So they have a time manner, and at the same time, they have a random question. It's not copied to each individual students. And these questions are all equal and can be equal to be fair. And students will have randomly 10 questions, could be good enough to really test their basic knowledge or any. It's like I tested before, it was great, and students really focus on just responding to the question, not to search for answers at all.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
Margaret, I'm gonna make an addition to what's been shared already, mm-hmm. in that we often think of assessment as being equated with quizzes and tests, but that we have many other tools that can also give us assessment information. And so I encourage faculty to consider assignments as their primary assessment approach, because assignments, course tasks, are often more aligned with the some of the activities that are a part of the discipline. So we often think that we have to have exams, but that actually, there's no law that we have to have exams. There are other ways that we can assess information, and I would definitely encourage faculty to do assignments. And in fact, I'm going to do a session at the beginning of the year virtual conference on good assignments and how they make for good assessments. So I definitely would be happy to talk with people about using assignments as an alternative to traditional exams.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeff.
And following up on what Jeff said, I think one of the things to keep in mind as students are just dealing with a lot of uncertainty and chaos right now is whether or, you know, do we really want to use a proctoring, a live proctoring scenario through, I think there are a couple of them out there. And I think UJA even has a live proctoring. And I've talked to a couple of students who are good students, but they're poor test takers. They have a lot of anxiety when they take tests. And when they sat at their computer and recognized that they were being watched through the camera, it heightened their anxiety. Mm-hmm. And and they performed even poorer on the exam. So I want to pony off of what Jeff said, just what are the other assessment options are there? And before we go to that, let's use the proctoring and quote unquote have somebody watching our students for the versions of proctoring that do that. Just think about maybe what the impact is on the student and all of our students. So that's my two cents.
Thank you, Nancy. That's very important.
Margaret, I have a question, Bill Wilson. I've asked this every time I meet with somebody and there's no answer. So I want to teach synchronously. The size of my class exceeds the planned reduced size of the classroom. So somebody has to be forced to take it online. Do you have any guidance on how I decide that? Or can I simply say whoever shows up in the classroom first?
So you're saying
not the only one who has this question.
Yeah, you're going to have a face-to-face offering, and then you're going to have a synchronous online offering at the same time. There are a couple different ways to do it. You could see who self-selects by finding out which of your students are planning to be face-to-face, which are planning to be remote. You could also see if the registrar comes up with a bigger classroom for you by fall semester, where you could get everyone into a larger classroom and you wouldn't have to have as many students going remotely. But Berry Hall is challenging in that even if we find bigger rooms, they would probably be on the main campus, and moving those students up to main campus throughout the day could be challenging. So you could also poll your students to see if they have a preference and see what you're looking at.
So let me give you the case that 100% say they want to be in the classroom.
Then we work really hard to try to find you enough space to accommodate that. And maybe you have two classrooms. Maybe you have, you know, 60 in one and 40 in the other, and one of those classrooms is remote. Yeah,
so in my case, I'm using a stylized lab. Is it okay to just have a rotation?
Particularly in labs and studios, we're finding we're going to have to do rotations because they can't all access the materials they need.
Thank you. I think giving guidance on that's useful because this is the first time someone's answered the question.
Okay.
And I notice quite a few people have the same question.
And I think maybe the reason you're not getting or others aren't getting clarity on that answer is because it's a little bit challenging in that we've been planning for 75% capacity in our classrooms since last spring. Throughout the summer, North Dakota is still on a level green, which allows 75% capacity or 65% in auditoriums. And in that regard, we were able to find spaces for nearly all of our classes to accommodate the social distancing in the space. Recently, we've decided it's probably in our best interest to look at 50% capacity in case the pandemic worsens in our region. It's easier to figure it out now than later, and that makes it a lot more challenging to use our existing classroom spaces and accommodate all our students. So we are adding additional classroom spaces. We're using several of the larger rooms in the Union and some other interesting spaces on campus that will be adapted with technology and allow us to spread out as we need to. And then as we move, you know, if we move Stevens Hall classes into Festival Concert Hall, for example, that opens up a nice big space in Stevens, so, or Gate City Auditorium. So we're still working on those things. The registrar is down to having spaces for everything except 106 courses, which, considering the number of courses we offer in the fall, is pretty darn impressive that we've gotten it down to those, that smaller number of bottlenecks. And now we're figuring out what to do with those particular courses. And so if you get a wishy-washy answer from me, it's because I don't really know yet. We're trying to figure it out, and we're getting awfully close to being able to release a new fall schedule. We didn't want to have to move days or times on courses because the vast majority of our students have already registered. And so to unregister them and re-register them to go later in the day or on different class days would be a nightmare. So we've been largely trying to accommodate our needs through space to try to keep them in their existing class schedule moving forward.
Margaret, we've got a number of questions on sanitizing between classes in the classroom and common areas. I don't know if that's a question you want to take or if you want to defer that to another session.
But. Well, I think Mike Ellingson is probably the best person to answer that, and his session might be tomorrow at noon.
His is tomorrow, and then Mike Bors is on Friday, and I think
They are more informed than I am with regard to the sanitation and disinfecting and whatnot. As I understand it, every classroom will not be cleaned in between every class. We simply don't have the capacity to do that, but there will be disinfectant and wipes available in all spaces, and we will encourage people to disinfect their own space so that students can wipe down their desks or their chairs or their lab stations. Faculty can wipe down the instructor podium. The one thing we know, though, is that if you are teaching in a room that has a plexiglass screen, please don't use normal disinfectant on that plexiglass because it will damage the finish. So they're trying to find an alternative cleaner that you can use on the plexiglass. I think Mark commented in the chat that we are trying to get individual microphones for every faculty member, so you'll have your own microphone you won't have to share. ITS has spent a lot of time over summer trying to figure out how to keep keyboards and mice sanitized. Everything from the wands that you wave over them to disinfect, which we've learned take a really long time to work, to sleeves that we could put on lap or keyboards. It may come down to the fact that you may walk into your classroom and find a box of disposable gloves that you should put on before you use a keyboard or the mouse, because that is about the cheapest and most effective way that
That's what we're looking at now.
Huh?
That's what we're looking at now, because I don't think we can, we were denied this request for the keyboard sleeves. So honestly, nothing we're going to do is going to beat washing your hands. So yeah, please do that too. And they are putting sanitizing stations around all over the place, so there should be a lot more access to a quick hand sanitizer. Mm-hmm. And one other thing, there were a lot of mask questions in here, and Mike Bohr is Friday, you said, Christy?
Can
probably, I don't know how much time we want to spend on that, but he can answer some of those questions. And maybe from a student disciplinary perspective, Laura Oster-Allen might be the person on that. I don't know how much time you want to take on it here or not, Margaret.
Well, we'll see what other questions we have. I can get into it if we need to. That seems to be what's on a lot of people's mind. The other thing I'm hearing a lot about from faculty is air quality in our classrooms and labs, and how safe is it? And Mike Ellingson is going to be able to talk about that with you during his session. The air quality in our classrooms is surprisingly higher than, or better than you might expect. So I feel pretty good about that, but they've also got some plans to do some ionization to improve air quality. Let's just let Mike talk about that.
Margaret, there were also a number of questions on if faculty will be notified if students test positive. Is that another one you want?
That is a better question for Laura Oster-Allen to respond to, and they're working on written materials to inform campus about that. So that's in process. It's a fine line between letting people know there's an active case in your classroom versus releasing personal healthcare information. So there will be a process in place for notification.
Mm-hmm. There's a question on assigned seating, and if there are seating charts for the room, do you need to document it?
Yes. We would like faculty to keep seating charts in their classrooms, so that if the state health department needs to do contact tracing, we're able to assist them in letting know who has been in proximity to someone who has been diagnosed as positive. I'm laughing because I thought I would send this email out 2 weeks ago, and I still haven't sent it because so many questions keep coming up whenever we talk about seating charts. So we do have floor plans that have all the seating laid out in our classrooms as they're currently set up. Facilities is going to be doing a lot of adaptation between now and the start of classes, though, to modify those environments. So in some classrooms, for example, the classrooms in the STEM building, they've gone in and removed chairs and tables to get down to a 50% capacity with proper social distancing. And the university has ordered seat covers for the auditoriums that, you can't sit in a chair that has a covering. So that's an example from one building. With the labs in the STEM building, they're going to take chairs out, but they're not going to uproot all the lab stations. But those spaces will be social distance. in the ballroom, as another example, and yes, we are probably going to be using the ballroom in the Memorial Union as a classroom this fall, in order to get the number of people into that ballroom and space them out, we're probably going to have to use the desks with arms. Do y'all know what I mean when I talk about the desks with arms? And they will likely be placed far enough apart so that if the room was full, you might have proper social distancing. But if you have a smaller class, you might have to follow stickers with who sits where. Or it's actually easier the smaller it is to space everybody out. So that's another example of how classrooms will be dealt with. We have so many different sizes and configurations and seating options in our classroom that it doesn't work to say, okay, we're going to put a sticker on every third chair, or we're going to do this, that, or the other. It really depends on the classroom, but facilities is putting a lot of time into figuring that out. We hope to have those seating charts adapted for you by the beginning of the semester so you can take attendance that way. But even if you have to take attendance on the full seating chart, I think you'll be able to do it. We just ask that your students sit in the same place every class period so that we can contact trace. Does that make any sense? Do you follow what I'm saying? Okay, thank you.
Can I just ask how many students? Oh, I see the response. Never mind.
I'm sorry, what?
Mark Wallman has already answered my question.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Excuse me, may I ask a question? Dr. Fitzgerald, regarding labs, I normally do field trips. I'm canceling them because I'm not going to get in a van with 15 kids and drive 40 miles one way to go look at wonderful soils. Mm-hmm. On campus, can I have kids drive their own cars? Here we're talking about a safety thing. It's very serious. So I don't know if I'm allowed to ask students to drive to a part of the campus that's on the, you know, contiguous grounds up by the airport on 19th.
Yeah, I think it would be good to work with the safety office on that. I do believe there are ways that students can drive their personal vehicles, but I would want to make sure that it is done appropriately. So I would say contact the safety office on how to do that.
That's fine. And it would just be one trip, most likely, but it's an experience that they would want. And then we'll just get a microphone, a big microphone, like a sports coach would use.
A sports coach.
a megaphone. Thank you.
When I'm going to put a plug in for geosciences, and David, I think they might be talking with you too about soil sciences. They can't do their normal field trip out to Western North Dakota to look at land formations. So they're purchasing a GigaPan system that helps do photographs of rock formations and make them much more realistic to what they would look like in the normal environment. So they, they're trying to find creative ways to accomplish that type of experience for the students by using technology. And I was actually over in the soils lab with Frank Casey the other day, and we're talking about, would this work for soil science too? So, and I don't know, because I don't know enough about it, but they might be talking with you about that too.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
We had some questions about lab courses that may not be able to be high flex. Is there guidance on components of experiential learning where social distance is difficult to maintain? And do we know like which classes will not be offered as high flex?
The departments have control over how they offer those lab courses and whether they'll be available high flex or not. And so I would say that if you're in a department that offers lab classes and you're not really sure how they're going to be delivered, you might want to visit with your department head and figure out what the plan is. And I know in some departments, it's still being figured out. I know biology has quite a few lab sessions to figure out yet. Chemistry would like to add additional lab sections to meet the demands for students in a couple of their labs, but they need to find qualified instructors to do it. And so some of those things are still being worked out. I'm sorry that I'm being so vague, but I'm not really sure what I can tell you about adapting a specific kind of lab, other than we will probably have to rotate students in our lab spaces because most of them aren't big enough to accommodate a full-size class, and most of them are set up in very unique spaces. The STEM building, as you would imagine, is probably the easiest building to get more students into safely because many of those rooms are just so very large. But in some of our other buildings, they're so very small.
One thing I would make a plug for in regard to these questions about experiential learning or labs, we're seeing it in performing arts in our college, is if you can set up forums or meetings with different departments that are facing this challenge, you can often get some good ideas from what others are doing. So the training is really fantastic, and thank you to IT for doing that. I'm just learning a lot from my fellow faculty when they say, so this is how I'm going to try and do that. So if you're like in college leadership and can set up something where people can exchange ideas, it could be really helpful right now.
That's a great idea, Carrie Ann. You know, just exchanging ideas on best practices with your colleagues is very, very helpful. And we can sure try to do things at the university level, but you can get it done much more quickly and much more effectively, probably if you have virtual coffee with some of your colleagues from across campus.
I had a question on if there are resources available for students who are working remote and have a poor or unreliable internet connection.
I think I'm going to have to defer to ITS on that one.
So the numbers, fortunately, we believe are very small. When everybody went home in March, Student Success and the Dean of Students Office kind of worked to survey students, and it was over 98% had internet connections that were adequate for doing remote work. The place where we had heard the most problems was North Central Minnesota. So if students are from there, there's not a whole lot we can do about it if they're in a rural area, because it's just a lack of providers. If they're in the area here, they will at least have access to it. So I think the numbers are small, and I think that that's kind of the Dean of Students Office who would work. And the same is with the students. Same is true of devices. If they don't have access to a good device, over 99% had access to a good device. So it's a smaller problem than I would have expected before this all happened.
Margaret, can I throw in a question here?
Yeah, hi, Mark.
Hi. Several people have asked on the chat about the good old mask question.
Okay.
I know that, you know, you have said and the university has said that students will be required to wear masks, and I know that we're going to put this on our syllabi and so on and so on. However, it's going to be up to each of us individually as instructors to enforce that. So I don't even know if this is a question for you alone. It's really a question for everybody. But I would like to know how we're going to enforce this and how we're expected to enforce it. So, you know, someone on the chat, Beth in the library, said students are going into the library, they're taking off their masks. So, you know, it seems pretty obvious we're going to have an enforcement issue, problem, challenge. And I'm wondering what people are thinking about this.
Yeah. When it comes to classrooms, and this is my personal take on it. When it comes to classrooms, your students are expected to wear face coverings during the class. We're trying to get messaging out to campus and to students before they return that that is the expectation on our campus, and we hope that they will abide by it. But when it's your particular classroom on a given day and you have to call the shots on what's going to happen, I would encourage you to, you know, put it in your syllabus and remind your students that they should have a face covering on every day. Talk about why it's important to try to protect the community. You've probably seen the Protect the Herd campaign that we've launched recently. But in terms of classroom management, if you have a belligerent student who's not going to settle down and who is refusing to wear their face coverings, I would ask that student to leave the premises because they are being disruptive. I suspect most of our students will be compliant. NDSU students tend to be fairly well behaved in general, and I would anticipate they would leave the environment. Someone asked me on another open forum, if they don't leave the environment, can you just cancel the class? And I would say, yes, you have the prerogative to do that. However, it makes me kind of sad to think that 99% of the students who comply get punished because one person doesn't cooperate. So I would try other strategies first before I would dismiss the class. If you have repeat offenders, you are to contact the Dean of Students, Casey Peterson, and his office will assist. If it's a faculty member who's not complying, you can contact their dean. If it's a staff member, you can work with HR. I have a lot of faith in our community, and I think that when people come back and see that face coverings are very prevalent on campus, everybody's wearing them. If you see somebody who's not, you should say, hey, you should get a face mask. I think people will comply. So, I don't know, Mark, does that help? Or
it does, thank you.
Yeah. I have maybe a general question. We work in indoor preparation. I don't know if anyone bring this question or these thoughts before, to have some spots, outdoor spots on campus so we can hold outdoor classes for small groups. Just all these kind of like outdoor is a good open environment, and for seminars, talking classes for a small group, it could be a good opportunity if we designate a few spots around the beautiful campus with the landscape to sit this. The students will enjoy it. Actually, we did it in our architecture downtown, but downtown is very limited. But I'm sure the big campus have a lot of interesting landscape to set up spots, designate spots for us to help small classes. So I'm not sure if somebody bring this, but I would like to see your ideas or thoughts about that.
I think that would be a good topic to bring up with facilities, because they oversee those outdoor spaces. I could easily see taking a small class to the Babbling Brook and meeting there. It would be a lovely environment. I think a lot of the music ensembles are practicing outside when it's nice. I believe I heard John Miller say concert choir is probably going to be outside when it's nice, and just because they can spread out and, you know, because with singing, that's particularly challenging with COVID. I remember in elementary school, if we got to go outside for a class, that was like the highlight of the day. Your college students might feel the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe the students like to get out from the enclosed environment and get some kind of a free breeze from fresh air and have a free talk. That's a wonderful. In our old building on the main campus, like Ailey Hall, we used to have a behind that Ailey Hall an open space. We used to have small classes to get out and sit in these kind of in spots. Between residents, there is big spots between the residence hall. It's a very nice landscape to be used for small groups gathering or small classes, especially seminars. If you don't need blackboard or projectors or any of these, it's better to get outside. That's my plea.
Just one more comment. Thanks to Kimberly Wallen, I've started doing walk and talk meetings with Jeff Boyer and Mike Kessler and the different people on campus that I work with, spend a lot of time over in the horticulture gardens actually having our meetings. And it's a great way to get out, get some exercise, get some fresh air and see parts of campuses. So I highly encourage you to think about walk and talk meetings or visiting outside. I'm sorry, I interrupted somebody who had started talking.
Oh, I just wanted to ask a follow-up to that because in my class, I'm thinking about doing walks outside, but I wouldn't have access to Wi-Fi or the internet, so I wouldn't be able to provide that experience synchronously. However, I could possibly record those sessions and have it available asynchronously. Is that acceptable?
I think we should talk to facilities about the extent to which we can start moving courses outside before I answer how we're going to do the pedagogy portion of it. I honestly don't know enough about the spaces on campus where we could be taking classes and how we prevent like seven classes from showing up at the Babbling Brook at 1 o'clock on Wednesday. Let's just hold on that one for a while.
Babbling Brook is the only place with official outdoor Wi-Fi. There's a lot of bleed from buildings, but so like if you want to go outside and stream, so apart from the facilities issue, if you want to stream a class from out there, depending on where you go, you may have some challenges.
Good point.
And we're looking at this. I brought this up to my staff. We're going to see what we can do to get some other spaces. Because even if it's not going to be used for classes, we're probably going to have students that might prefer to study outside rather than indoors. So we're doing what we can on that.
Exactly. Mark, you are right. Because most of the dorm is like two students in a room. It's very compact to spend hours in that dorm rooms. So it's good to provide more internet access to the outdoor spaces around the residential spots that students can really get out and study outside. Spending more hours outside the building is much more appreciated during this kind of fall semester. It's just very, very compacted rooms and the space is very tight. Because I'm an architect, so I'm a designer, I understand how tight is a space. But for this kind of condition, we need to provide more outdoor opportunities for students to study or learn or enjoy outside.
With that said, I am now 8 minutes late for my 1 o'clock meeting. So if we could wrap this up for today, I appreciate your taking time to visit. Very much like to know what questions and concerns that you have so that we can address them and try to figure things out. I know the next couple weeks are going to go really, really quickly, but I'm confident that we'll have lots of things in place by the time classes start, and you'll be getting more information through the next few weeks. So thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thank you.